Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Michael Bush. I represent Ron Burdette. This is an Eighth Amendment case coming out of Butte County. It arises out of an incident that occurred in Butte County Jail in which Mr. Burdette, who had recently arrived to the jail, was taken off of prescription medicine that had been taken for a long time. Within a time frame recommended by or noticed by the manufacturer of the drug, Mr. Burdette had a predictable seizure. He fell, hit his head on the cement, and now has permanent brain injury.
Well, when he had the seizure, was he not on Imipramine?
He was on Imipramine. Yes, he was.
So it wasn't from withdrawal, and both those drugs have possibility of seizures, so he was on a different drug, but he was on a drug which was appropriate, wasn't it, for his illness?
No.
It was an inappropriate drug?
It was an inappropriate drug. The drug that he had been taking for years was Xanax, and that was the drug that they were taking him off of and substituting Imipramine.
Inappropriate in what sense? You mean it was malpractice to prescribe it?
Not so much in that sense, although that comes up as an issue in these types of cases. No.
But you have to show more than malpractice.
Absolutely.
Here. This cannot, I mean, if this is a malpractice case,
it's not
you're
a
out.
Malpractice case.
You're out.
I understand that, and I agree with that. I think that's a good standard. But
what evidence is there in the record? It's true that between the two drugs, there's some evidence in terms of, I think, there was some testimony or there was admissible evidence that had to do with that Xanax was the better drug now than Imipramine but the only thing, I didn't see anything that you put in the record that showed that there was some incredible risk of that. I think there was some reference from that it was a 0.4% risk, but your record was devoid of showing that there was some incredible risk of that.
The record shows that the manufacturer of the drug and the doctor is aware of what the manufacturer says. There's a 0.04% risk of seizure from tapering off of the Xanax drug if you taper it off too quickly. That's in the record.
But that was introduced by the appellees, correct?
Well, we agree with it. We agree. The question is, how do you qualify that? And that comes to the first point that we raised on this appeal, is whether or not that 0.04 is considered a substantial risk or an excessive risk. And it's in this regard, I would like to just have the court deal with something that's very confusing. 0.04 in the recommendation from the manufacturer is a substantial number. It's not an excessive number by any means, but it is substantial. It's the only risk factor listed in the whole category of things that could go wrong. It's the only one that has a percentage. It clearly indicates that the manufacturer thinks that the seizure at 0.04 is substantial enough to be told about its percentage. But 0.04 would not be excessive.
It's available for doctors to use, and it's not, I don't think it's, well, below the standard of care doesn't really matter here because you don't want this to be a Med-Mal case. That's not a good thing for your client.
Right.
But, you know.
Here's what we think.
Is that indifference?
Here's what I think is why it comes to that. Anytime you're looking at a case like this, you're going to have the possibility of negligence, medical malpractice, and at what point does that become deliberate indifference? And what I believe is the situation is that when you see something that makes you think there might be negligence or medical malpractice, that's a warning sign to take a deeper look and to see what the motivations are to see if, in fact, in addition to negligence or malpractice, we rise to the level of deliberate indifference.
Well, why don't you answer this question? This is a summary judgment. What can you point to in the summary judgment record that would support an inference of deliberate indifference?
The history, and I pointed out in the brief that this doctor and this prisoner had a four-year history. And the first time that this doctor met this particular patient was he had already been in jail for 6 months on a DUI, taking the medication, the Xanax, every day. This doctor gets a job at the jail, and he continues giving this guy his medication for six more months. The way it works is that family members bring the medication to the doctor, because it's not on the formulary of the jail. Family members bring it to the doctor. An event occurred where the family members weren't going to bring it, and it's noted in the record at page 221 that the doctor then says, well, I'm going to have to take you off because there is no medicine. 3 days later, the family brings him medicine, brings it to him at his outside job. He takes two of them and brings it in to the doctor. The doctor notes in the record that, oh, you're caught taking medicine that I'm taking you off of. Now I'm taking you off of this and all your medicine.
But isn't that, but I think the four-year course of action in a way works against you because he's treated him for 4 years and he doesn't, and he never had this seizure.
That's not accurate. He knows him
for
4 years.
Did he have any other seizures in the 4 years? Well, I know. He's in and out of jail over that period of time.
And the doctor is in and out of employment also. He doesn't work sometimes when Mr. Burdett is back at the jail. He sees him 3 years after the first event. He sees him 3 years later.
All right, but on the previous times when he put him on the drug holiday, as it were, I think as it's referred to, did he ever have a seizure any of those times?
The two times...
I mean, is there any evidence in the record? Not whether... That's what we obviously have to
deal with. Not the first time. Not the first time in 1997. There's no evidence of a seizure. Okay. The second time that he took him off, he was only in jail for 3 days. So he was not taken off completely off the drug before he was back out and being treated by his normal physician. The third time is the time that caused the problem.
Well, and do we know, or is there anything in the record that says the seizure came from taking him off the drug, or the seizure came from the Imprimane which he was taking, or what? Is that a? I couldn't find where that really was discussed in the record. Can you tell me about that?
We never got that far in the case. There's doctors that had submitted declarations saying that, in their opinion, it's likely that taking him off Xanax that quickly caused a seizure.
That still doesn't get you to the indifference. I mean, establishing that link would be something that you'd have to do in a Med Mal suit. But how would that establish? Let's say it did cause it. But where is that, you know, there are things that happen that doctors do that are wrong that does cause injury to people or it ends up being the case. But how's that indifference?
There's a couple of ways that the indifference showed up. One, in the way the doctor took him off without telling anybody on the staff to watch out for this particular critical period of time, which the manufacturer says to the doctor is 24 to 72 hours after cessation. There's no indication. In fact, there's nothing in his record that says he tells the nursing staff to look out for this guy. The nursing staff doesn't even know that this person is being reduced off a drug that could cause this type
of
problem.
You're not claiming medical indifference on the part of Nurse Bobby, even though you're taking fault with her, the way she treated him. But she's not a defendant, right?
That's right.
The only defendant is who?
Is the doctor.
None of the jailers, guards, or anything else.
The county, the county, yes.
Yeah.
Your Monell claims.
Right.
Do you want to save a little bit of time? I'll give you a minute on rebuttal. All right?
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Lanius, and I represent the appellee, Dr. Lancaster. There is no deliberate indifference to any serious medical need. When Mr. Burdett comes into jail in the middle of November of 2000, Dr. Lancaster meets him. He tells him he has a panic attack, and that's his medical need. Dr. Lancaster prescribes imipramine, wants to get him off the addictive substance Xanax, knows him from years past. They successfully weaned him in 1997. He was in the jail for 6 months after being weaned off the drug with no seizures or other problems. In 2000, he was back in March, and it was more than 3 days. He tapered him off for over a week. This time he comes in and he's going to taper him off again. And he has said that he knows there's a risk. It's 0.4. We submit that's not a substantial risk. But nonetheless, he acknowledges the risk, and not with deliberate indifference, but instead he carefully tapers it for a longer period of time this time in order to purposely avoid the risk of seizure associated with taking patients off these drugs. So
what does 0.4 mean? Or
four patients out of every 1,000 taking this drug. Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that's after quick or immediate cutting them off. The way to deal with it and the recommendations across the board are don't make them go cold turkey, taper them. And that's what he did. He saw him again. The other mental health staff saw him. There was never an indication that he had another serious medical need in connection with the tapering or anything else.
But why was he then given imipramine?
Because the doctor was addressing his complaints of a panic attack condition. This was the
imipramine is a depression drug.
Well, Your Honor,
Xanax is more of a drug for panic. As I understand it.
Well, imipramine, there's different schools of thought.
What does the record show?
Dr. Mlotok says that it's an old-fashioned drug that he doesn't prefer. Dr. Lancaster testified it is a drug that can be used appropriately and effectively for panic attacks. And I believe there may be another declaration in support of the motion to that effect as well.
All right, so that's what we're limited to for purposes of deciding this case.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor. So, but then counsel tends to confuse the issues, and when you read through his briefs, such as his opening brief, page 15, he's talking about bigger staff's, Nurse Bobby's, response to the problems that very morning on December 2nd when she was called in by the jailers, saw him, concluded she did not need to call a medical doctor, and then he comes into the pill line at 6:30 and collapses and has his injury. Dr. Lancaster has no subjective awareness that these problems are going on. She never calls him. So he can't be held to be deliberately indifferent to any medical need associated with this reaction occurring at that time. Instead, what he has done is...
Is there any evidence in the record that he had knowledge of that?
Absolutely none, Your Honor. In fact, it's all to the contrary. It's to the effect that he did not know it. And no one called anybody. Bobby Biggerstaff decided this patient's not in big problem. I don't need to call him. In the last two visits to mental health people in the record at 246, for example, the licensed clinical social worker states that he does not appear to be in any obvious distress, and that's on November 27th. On December 1st, the day before this, he sees the licensed psychiatric nurse. And he says, broad effect, alert and oriented, pleasant, cooperative. So Dr. Lancaster has never been deliberately indifferent to any medical attention, and he should not be held liable for the claim of violating this gentleman's due process right or the constitutional prescription against cruel and unusual punishment.
I want to ask one question. Were the drugs being supplied by the jail or by the family?
On this occasion, he was arrested in Montana and transported to Butte County. He brought his own supply. When they bring him into the jail, they take those drugs. So the drugs were there in the dispensary.
How about the imipramine? Who brought that?
Well, the imipramine was provided by the county jail through their formulary and pharmacy there.
So Xanax was available if the doctor wanted it.
True.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Deems, and I represent the county defendants, and this will be brief because I think we're sharing our time. The plaintiff's claim against the county defendants fails for two reasons, two fundamental reasons. Number one, since Dr. Lancaster's decision to taper Burdett's Xanax was not the result of deliberate indifference. It was therefore not unconstitutional. There is no liability under Monell if the act complained of is not unconstitutional. Number two, this gets us to the drug holiday issue. Even if the county of Butte had a drug holiday policy, Dr. Lancaster was not following it. That is based on the plaintiff's own admission in response to the defendant's statement of undisputed facts. The drug holiday wasn't the basis for Dr. Lancaster's actions. We have the undisputed fact that Dr. Lancaster was tapering Mr. Burdett from his Xanax and at the same time replacing that with imipramine. That does not even fall within the definition of what's been described as the drug holiday.
Is there any written policy in the record?
There's no, and I'm using this just for argument.
Was mentioned with the declarations or the evidence that was presented
there is
by
no,
the appellant.
No, there is no record that there is actually a drug holiday policy. Butte County wasn't aware that there was anything that was being described as a policy.
I think there was, I can't remember if it was the way the declaration, but there's that persons?
Yes, all persons.
But did persons indicate that he reported complaints to...
He reported complaints to the county. The term drug holiday, as we understand it, was coined by either Dr. Lancaster or somebody else early on. It was just a treatment modality that was established by the medical professionals that were involved in treating the inmates at the county jail. The county itself did not do anything to implement that policy. It was not county employees that were using the policy. The only issue was really in terms of whether there was a policy or not. Did the county know that there was a treatment modality called drug holiday, and should they have done something about that? We're just assuming for the sake of argument, what if there was? It's not at issue here. There is no causal connection between any drug holiday policy, even if one existed, and the plaintiff's injuries based on plaintiff's own admissions and the facts of this case. So on that, I would submit it.
All right, thank you. All right, you have 1 minute for rebuttal.
To just backtrack,
I'm giving the appellant 1 minute for rebuttal.
Certainly. The statement that we admitted that there was no policy, we started this case thinking the county had the policy and the doctor followed it. Through discovery, we found it was the doctor had the policy, and the shift then goes to the county acquiescing to it. Yes, Paul Persons told the county. Yes, the county knew there was a policy, and this doctor it was his policy.
How did the county know there was such a policy?
That the testimony of Paul Persons, who was an attorney who had filed a jail conditions class action against the county and was monitoring county jail conditions, reported on a periodic basis.
He reported that inmates complained about not getting their drugs.
Right. So they were aware of it.
They didn't say drug holiday, did they? The inmates complained they didn't get their drugs, right? Was that...
But the term has always been drug holiday. That's what we were told it was when we first started. That was called drug holiday.
Well, but did Persons tell the county your policy of drug holiday? What does your evidence show on that? Isn't it that he reported complaints that people didn't get their drugs, right?
You're right.
I want to know what the evidence is.
But the phrase drug holiday is definitely used by the doctor. They knew the doctor was doing something, whether they call it drug holiday.
All right. Well, thank you for your argument. Your time has expired. All right. This matter will now stand submitted. Next case on calendar is Gregana Nikolov Ivalova versus John Ashcroft. Cases number 03715070, 03715080, 03715113. Those cases are presently submitted on the briefs in this matter. The court will be in recess just briefly, and then we'll return and continue with the calendar.
I got it. This call should not be in session.
All right, we're back in session. I understand we were looking out here, and I didn't know that you'd be here. We have a number of visitors. Is that Urban High School?
Yes.
And where is that? And what year students do we have?
We're juniors and seniors. We're doing a constitutional law class, so they know what the word remand means.
Well, thank you for joining us. We always like to see students here. I know it's probably not quite as exciting as watching some of the shows on TV, but it's every bit as important, if not more important. And we thank all of the council for their fine arguments today. But I think probably, as you've seen, in appellate courts, we're not doing the trials, we're not actually hearing the witnesses or doing any of that. That's already happened before people get here in front of us. So we're dealing with the legal issues. And I know sometimes if you haven't read the briefs before, which we all have, it doesn't maybe sound quite as exciting or as quick moving, but it's really, I see a lot of heads nodding there, but by the same token, it's actually quite interesting if you're able to read everything before and, notice the focus on it. And I'm glad that you know what a remand is, even though, that may not have been an issue that you were aware of, but the federal courts have been waiting for the Supreme Court to rule about the federal guidelines and what we're supposed to do. And we got 2 days ago, I guess, or we got a 128-page opinion, which everyone's trying to digest and figure out what's going on. So the lawyers do the best to tell us what they think happened, and we're, a lot of times there's a period in the law after a big decision comes about that we talk a lot about it in the courts and decide how what the Supreme Court meant when they did it. Anyway, I would like to call the next matter, and that's Zhang versus Ashcroft 0371837. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Vanderhout appearing on behalf of Mr. Zhang, who's here in court.